Please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight from our own very own home group, Miss Nina.
Well, hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'm going to set this out of the way. I'm a teacher, so if you want to have my note cards, you just have to have my note cards or I won't survive. My name is Nina. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is August 1st, 2022. This was my first home group and still is my home group. I also have an online home group. But I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about my journey to where I am now and where hopefully it will stay. All right, I'm going to start out just telling a little bit about myself. I'm from, you guys may have heard of this, Franklin County, Virginia. Has anybody ever heard of that? The moonshine capital of the world. Go figure. We lived, you know, I grew up way out. It was a very rural area. So, you know, it was always, this is Lafuse area. And this is where the Floras are. But, you know, you had the Lafuse on the hill or, but I remember hearing the stories that my grandmother would tell about, oh yeah, Mr. Kennedy, they had a still back in such and such. And you know, all of our neighbors had stills somewhere out there. I don't remember anybody on my dad's side of the family drinking all that much. So I don't know that they really partook from the stills. But it was just kind of an interesting place to grow up. I remember all the helicopters going over looking for the stills as a kid. You know, like they used to look for folks that were driving too fast. But anyway, the town that I grew up in, it just seemed like, I mean, drinking was just a part of things. I mean, not excessive drinking. I mean, nobody really thought they drank to excess. It was just drinking. They're going to have a party. Everybody drank. My parents would drink with their friends. The relatives were all drinking. So it was an environment where everybody was drinking, but it wasn't bad. It was kind of like accepted, I guess, because of mountain people and so forth. As a kid, I don't remember a time. My story's kind of boring until I get like to the 60s and then it'll make more sense. My 60s. But I don't remember a time ever not being able to get home on my own steam, because I knew if I didn't get home by myself, I was going to be in big trouble. I had a dad that was like 6'2". He was the man of the house, the dad, you know. And we had a big picture window in the front of our house. It was up on a hill. So you knew you were in big trouble if you were coming up the hill and you saw this shadow walking back and forth in front of the picture window. It meant you were late. So I never wanted to get in trouble that way with him, because it would not have been good. Childhood events that I think, I can't blame the things that happened around me as a kid. They didn't make me an alcoholic, but they sure kind of, you know, primed the pump for that, you know. I had a younger sister. There was only myself and my sister. My younger sister was like the darling of the family. She was the youngest. She was adorable. She had a lot of misfortune, which is, you know, sad, but still got her a lot of attention. When she was 18 months old, she had some kind of really high fever, made her eyes cross. So she had to have eye surgery. So it was constant people coming to check on her, to see how she was doing, to bring her presents. So that was kind of like, I'm like, okay, she's cool, but you know, what about me? I'm here too. See, I was already self-centered at that age. I remember one time we were renting a house that was on a dairy farm, and we were all running around the kitchen, and my mother was ironing, and my sister went and grabbed the cord from the iron and pulled it down on her head, and it went in point first. So, you know, it was total panic. You know, head wounds, they bleed like crazy. It probably wasn't really that bad, but you know, being who she was and already, you know, being so taken care of, they grabbed her, threw her in the car, threw me in the car, and halfway to Roanoke, which was about 30, 35 minutes away, they realized I was in the car. And they didn't want to take me to the hospital. So they dropped off at the local Texaco, because everybody knew Doc. Everybody knew Doc. He ran to Texaco. Left me with Doc. I remember sitting on the counter playing. I don't know if you guys probably won't remember this. Some of my older folks. Texaco used to have the dinosaurs. And I remember him getting out all the dinosaurs, just trying to keep me busy until somebody could come and pick me up. So, I mean, it doesn't sound that traumatic, but it, you know, it kind of was, just to be left like that. My sister, when at our age, and I am going to be 66 next week, but at our age, you didn't have to go to kindergarten. It was not required. So mom's like, cool beans, you stay with grandma. So I got to stay with my grandma, but my sister, because she was so special, she got to go to a special kindergarten in Roanoke. She got to go to a special babysitter. It was just all, you know, because they were worried about her, because she had had such a rough time. So that was another thing where I just felt like just wasn't that important, you know? And whenever I got really sick, they would ship me off to stay with an aunt that lived in the country if it was something they hadn't had before. So I got to go stay for 2 weeks with an aunt, a great aunt that I barely knew, because I had the mumps and nobody in the family had had the mumps before. So I got to stay there. That's, you know. And all of these things, I think, I mean, I can't say, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I would think with all of that going on that I kind of grew up thinking I really wasn't all that special. You know, there was always somebody that needed a little bit more attention. Again, not anything that I should start taking a bottle for, but it stayed in my mind. I really, and I don't know if this is common, but I really don't remember a whole lot about my childhood. I don't. Maybe 5 or 6 events, and that's it. And what's interesting is I've talked to my sister about that too, and she doesn't remember much either. So we want to get together soon and try to figure out what the hoo-ha was going on, because something had to be strange, but we're not sure. But anyway, my childhood. I always felt different, constantly. At home, I felt different because I wasn't constantly being taken care of and pampered. I felt different around my friends. Most of my parents' friends, even though we didn't have any money, had lots of money. So all of my friends were taking ballet lessons and gymnastics, and I was going home and playing in the woods, which was fine, but I just didn't feel the same, you know, as they did. I know that I always pushed the limits, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. You know, I was a people pleaser. I was terrified to tell people I wouldn't do things, especially my dad. But in my head, I'm going, oh, yeah, right, I'm going to do that. You know, I just was always pushing the limits. I, as a kid, I think from the age, probably 4th grade, I took over all the responsibilities of doing the laundry at the house, cleaning the house, cooking the meals for the house, and pretty much raising my little sister. So that put a lot of responsibility on someone who probably didn't need to have that kind of responsibility, because I don't think I was all that solid at that point anyway. We had plenty of opportunities to get drunk, my friends and I. You know, the parents had, I don't remember a single friend whose parents didn't have, you know, a stock of their prized moonshine somewhere in the liquor cabinet, in addition to everything else. So we had plenty of opportunity, you know, to get drunk if we wanted to. We just never really did. We did have, one of our friends owned an apple orchard, Okemichi Orchards. I don't know if y'all have ever heard of that, but they had one of the most modern houses in town. They had a lake that was named after them. They had a farm with horses that was named after them. But the cool thing was is they had all the packing houses there and all of the sharecropper sheds up in the mountains. So when we got to be about teenagers, I guess our parents thought it was safer to let us just hang out in one of the sheds. So we would go up there and hang out in the house from like 6 o'clock to whenever. So if we ever wanted to drink, which we did sometimes, it was there. But I don't remember anybody getting, you know, completely wacko out of their brains. All right, as I said before, I did always get into mischief. I don't know how, but we lived on a dairy farm, and I'd always been warned, stay away from that field. Don't go in there. It's not safe. So you know me, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go in there. So they came out one afternoon, and I'm standing in the field with their bull, you know, and he's looking at me, not getting happy. I'm in the pen with the bull, so somebody had to come and pull me out. Got in lots of trouble for that. In school, I always got terrible conduct reports. I was just a talker and would get into trouble all the time. See, y'all wouldn't think that of me, would you? Because I'm such a... But I was in constant trouble, terrible trouble. I always wanted to be the center of attention, go figure. I'm still like that a lot, still. Even though I don't act like it, my husband laughs at me all the time. He goes, what do you want me to tell you, at a girl, or you had a good day? Because I know you want some attention for that, because that's the way I am. I come home and I'm going, guess what happened in class today? And he's like, what? you know, and I'm just waiting for him to praise me for it. Some of these were fun, though. My friend who lived in town, and we never got drunk. I don't know why we even did this. We were just looking for trouble. But we would beg her parents when I spent the night to let us stay in the sunroom. They had one of those beautiful old brick houses that were built around the turn of the century. And they had like an atrium on the side, you know, a sunroom, all glass. It was beautiful. So we always wanted to sleep there. And they thought, oh, they want to be near nature. That is so wonderful. We wanted to be there because when the train came through town, and it always came through town about 11:30, 12 every night, we knew that you could open the doors. You had to time it right. Open the door, sneak out, close the door while the train was going through town because you couldn't hear anything. So we would run downtown. We'd usually get somebody to pick us up something to drink. And this was, again, the orchard people had a fruit stand. So we would go there, get a bottle of wine, and we would go up and sit up at the train station, which was closed. But I just thought that was such a wild thing. It was one of those old ones like they have everywhere, but they're trying to redo, like in downtown Suffolk, the old white train station's beautiful. Where was that? Oh, and then another thing that surprises me is I was in bars all the time, not because I was drinking, but because my boyfriend played bass in a band. So I had a fake ID, you know, to go and listen to him play. So I ended up having a car wreck on the way home from work one night. Somebody pulled out in front of me and I T-boned them. And all of a sudden I've got this girl running over to my car. Do you have a fake ID? Do you have, you know, we gotta get that. Do you have anything in your car? And I'm like, I don't drink. But then the police officer comes over with it in his hand. He goes, yes, she does have one, but we have it. But at that time I was already 18, so it didn't really matter. But I was constantly just getting in trouble all the time, which should have been a warning to my parents. But where am I now? The way I see it, the more I look at it and think about it, I think my whole childhood was just kind of like honing those alcoholic characteristics. You know, just kind of looking at everything that was going on and just, I don't know, for some reason it just put it in my head. I mean, I always wanted more. I mean, I call that my biggest addiction. I wanted more. I'm like that today. If I find a top that I like and it looks good, then I will buy every flipping color so that I have it in my closet. I just want everything. I was impulsive, obviously. I did then and I do now get frustrated very quickly. If I can't do things perfectly the first time, I'm done with it. I don't want to mess with it anymore. It's always very sensitive. Just a whole list of things. I'm trying to see what else on here. Judgmental, all of the things. So that's kind of leads me up to college. Now, you know, when you go to college, everybody drinks and has a good time. When I went to college, you know, you could buy beer at 18. You know, you could buy anything you wanted to at 18, not liquor. So that was not a problem. We drank in school all the time, not excessively, but it was just a thing that everybody did. Something else I was gonna say about that, and it went right out of my head. Imagine that. But, the town that I grew up in, Franklin County, of course, was a dry county. You guys know what that means? But Boone's Mill was not, and that's the town that I lived in. So everybody rushed to Boone's Mill on Sundays, you know, to get their beer. So it was just a fun place. All right, then, I'm going so fast, I apologize if I'm going to finish too early. But loved going to college, loved it. You know, I had freedom. We all loved going to college. I had freedom. I didn't have to take care of anybody anymore. I didn't have to clean the house for people anymore. I just had a great time. I met my husband. You know, we had a very blessed life. I met my husband. We have four kids that are pretty wonderful most of the time. We did have our first three very close together within 5 years. And then 10 years later, we had an oopsie. And I think that one kind of, you know, that kind of threw me for a loop too, because I'd gone through all the craziness with the others. And then here comes this new one to deal with. But I wasn't young anymore. I was in my 40s and my 50s. So it's kind of hard. I always, and I think I've shared this before, but I always tried to make everything look perfect. You know, it had to look perfect. It had to look like what I was doing with my kids was perfect. You know, the house was perfect. We went to the conference at the beach a couple years ago, and they had someone there that was an Al-Anon speaker. And she said, you might as well have put a sign up in our front yard saying, nothing to look at here, everything's fine, we're all fine, this is perfect, we're all fine. And that's kind of the way I felt I was you know, doing with my family until the kids got old enough to say, well, it's not always so perfect. But at that time, appearances were everything to me. My mother drank too much. And I remember, you know, because we were in a very small town, you know, her getting on the phone with someone and making a complete fool of herself and then hearing about it all around town. So I wanted to make sure that wasn't going to happen with my kids. We were going to be perfect. Nobody was going to talk about us. Yeah, when I had my kids, you know, we drank. My husband and I drank, you know, not excessively, but we drank. But you're so busy running around trying to take care of, you know, all these little people and get the things they need and get them to school and feed them. And it was just a lot. So I really didn't have a lot of time to really do a lot of recreational drinking. It was just work, work, work. And then I started teaching, which was even crazier. That just kept me super busy. So I drank at that point to relax. You know, I drank to relax. I drank to have fun. I mean, Friday nights and the weekends were like, yes, we can finally chill and not have to worry about getting up early. And I did this up until I stopped drinking, to just to quiet my mind. I had been a person that always had to be busy. You know, my dad didn't tolerate anybody just sitting around not doing something. So I constantly had to be doing something. So the only way I could really just sit and be was to have some drinks. And then I would use them to go to sleep too. And it really became a cure for, you know, everything that was bothering me, that stressed me out. And then of course, over the years, because that started like in my early 30s, you know, by my 50s, I was kind of having some problems with that. It was getting to be a little bit too much fun. It was really starting to control a lot of what I did. I started drinking privately so that nobody would see me drinking. You know, I would go get my wine. I'd have a couple of glasses before David could get home so he wouldn't know, you know, that I had something to drink. And then I would sit down with him. He'd go, would you like a glass of wine? I'm like, no, that would be nice. And, if I had wine, and this man, he's a saint. He never knew I had a drinking problem until I actually said I was going to go to Farley. He goes, I just thought you were tired all the time. Because by the time he would come home, I would be on the couch passed out asleep. Because I knew you worked hard. So I was busy, busy, busy. And then the kids went off to college and doing their own things. And then all of a sudden, your life is kind of, I mean, what do? What's your purpose? You teach, yeah, you know. But all the stuff that you used to do for them, you know, you don't have that to do anymore. So, I mean, look at where I am. I would plan all of my nights around making sure that I had something to drink and that David didn't know what was going on. Now, mind you, we still had the little one at home who was probably at that point maybe 10 or 11. But she said, I talked to her the other night. I always felt I was the worst mom in the world to her. Not the other ones, but to her. And when I told her I was doing my story tonight, she goes, oh my God, you're not going to talk about me, are you? I said, no, I'm not going to talk about you. I said, but we do have to sit down and talk. And I've been telling her we need to sit down and talk, and she doesn't want to. And so she said that night when I was talking to her, this was a couple nights ago, she goes, well, you really weren't that bad. And I'm thinking this my whole time that I had been this horrible stumbling around drunk thing, but that's what your head does to you. All right, so this is when it started to get a little dicey. My daughter, she told me this. I took it as a compliment. I didn't realize at the time. She goes, Mom, you're just a high-functioning alcoholic. And I went, look at me. I'm at the top of the line. I'm high. I had no idea, you know, what that meant until I did some reading. They must have thought, boy, Mom didn't, you know, her brain wasn't working very well. But at that point, you know, I was working at school. I wasn't having, you know, I never had a DUI. I never lost family members. I mean, I just was very lucky. God was looking out for me. Somebody was. But at school, I would just work my butt off. Because at that point, you're feeling kind of worthless. Because, you know, because you're drinking and sneaking around all the time. So I busted my ass at school. Anything they needed done, I did it. I did the clubs. I did the before and after school meetings. I mean, I was there doing stuff for a good 28, 29 years before I really started having problems. So kind of built up my reputation You know, so nobody would ever look at me and go, what? What? Again, I was a type A personality, got to work. I wanted everybody to look at me and go, yeah, that is what a teacher should be. And in my mind, I'm thinking, boy, I got you guys snowed big. But you know, it never really affected my teaching because I made sure, until it got to the very end, I made sure that I was good when I went to school. I mean, my kids got 110% of me no matter what. And then it got to the point where it was taking too much of my energy to control my drinking habits and what I needed. I mean, I would get up in the morning and I had to make sure that any wine that I may have left out, you know, that it wasn't around so David could see it. I loved those little, I used to drink out of the bottles, but they make too much noise when you try to throw them away and they're hard and hot. So I did, seriously, I did the little, I love the little black boxes. Have y'all seen those? They have the big one, the mama. That was for weekends at first. But then they had the little baby ones. And so those were perfect. They had about 3 glasses of wine in them. Of course, it only usually got to be about 1.5 for me. I used a glass this tall. But I would have to think in the morning, okay, where is it? Is it in the trash? Or if I hid it, where did I hide it? Because, you know, I wanted to find it, but I didn't want anybody else to find it either. And at that point, you know, my girls especially were getting smart to the fact that something was going on. So they were sneaking around and looking for stuff. They should have had more respect for me. What in the world? In the mornings, I had to decide, okay, do I have time to get my wine after school and get home before David gets home? Or should I pick it up on the way into school and just put it in the back of the car? And mind you, I'm terrified the whole day. This is so silly. If some random person's going to go look in the back of my car and see wine and go tell on me to the principal. But, you know, it was exhausting. If I had like a meeting at school, I would have to make sure I left early enough to get to the meeting and buy my wine. And I know this one, going to the grocery store, I had to switch out grocery stores. I had to make sure I went to different ones so nobody would recognize me. And then when I got lazy about that, I would go to the same grocery store, but I made sure I didn't go to the same cashier. And I even walked out sometimes because I didn't want this guy to know that I was buying wine all the time. And I still see him to this day when I go in there, and I felt like he was always looking at me going, poor thing. He didn't have a clue. I mean, I don't think he had a clue. And then, you know, this is the thing that got me too, is like when they would go out, I would wait until I was sure they'd gotten out of the neighborhood, then I would call and have wine delivered. But there were those times when, you know, oh my God, the guy's not here yet, what's going on? And then sometimes they almost caught me getting the delivery from the front door. So those were very scary, terrible times, for me anyway. I would limit myself, depending on what kind of day I'd had, I would either buy one baby black box. If I was gonna be, you know, a little crazy, I'd get 2. If it was gonna be a big night, I would get 3 of them, and I would gauge how much I was drinking by how many of those I went through. You know, some nights 1, 1.5 would do it. Some nights, you know, 3 wasn't enough, but that was just such a crazy way of thinking. I'm gonna do light tonight. I'm only gonna have 3 glasses of wine instead of, and this is the funny one, is I would hide the black boxes in different places, little trash bags, and then in the morning after my husband left, I would go collect all the black boxes in the trash bags, and I would make sure that I stopped by Food Lion or gas station so I could throw my trash away there so that nobody would find it at home in the trash can. I mean, it made sense to me. What do I have here? Oh, and then I'm going to talk about COVID in a little while, but when they started doing the deliveries, that was just like the best thing in the world. If any of y'all were drinking then, you know, I didn't have to worry about already having something to drink and put people in danger to go to the grocery store and buy more. I would just call and have them delivered. But I had to make it legit. Like I would order maybe a couple of black boxes, but I would order a big ass roast to cook for dinner because, you know, that would kind of cover up the cost. And then if he got mad, I'd say, but I paid you a roast for dinner, you know. It was just so twisted. I realized that I could order from Walmart and Target, and that opened up a whole realm of possibilities. Because he would go, you just ordered something yesterday, what is this? I said, remember I told you I was gonna order those books from my classroom, and Target is the only one that had them. And so, you know, I got out of it that way. He was like, okay. Because he would never tell me not to buy something from my classroom. That was just useless to even tell me that, because I would buy it and it would be there. And then I would get things from Walmart, and he'd go, what is this? I told you I needed more crayons, more paper for the classroom. And he'd be like, oh yeah, that's right, that's right. So I just was awful in that respect. Then it really started to get kind of scary. You know, the weekends were my big drinking time, and Sundays especially, because we didn't have soccer games or any of that stuff on Sunday. I could just drink all day long. And I stopped early enough so that I would be okay the next morning. But I would wake up with this dread. I mean, I would wake up at like 4:30 or 5 in the morning and go, oh my God, you know, I can't do this. I can't drive to school. I'm going to kill somebody on the way to school. You know, it was just terror, pure terror. But I was together enough that I would get up at like 4:30 or 5 and I would start emailing my teachers, because I was a specialist teacher, a resource teacher. So I didn't have like my own group that came to me and stayed with me all day long. I would start emailing my teachers at like 5:30, 6 in the morning. Sorry to bother you guys this early, but I'm really sick and I just wanted to let you know. And I would have my whole schedule made up for the week so that I could see everybody's classes that I was missing on Monday mornings. And because I had done so much at the school and my reputation was so good, nobody ever questioned it. It was never a problem. They were like, well, you need a break. I'm sorry. And I would love the ones that would say, well, I hope you feel better soon. And I'm thinking in my head, I hope so too, but it's not for the reason you think. It was just bad. I was either scared to go to school or I was physically sick to go to school. It was just scary. Missed a lot of Mondays, but then again, my job made it super easy because I made up my own schedule. So eventually I started getting smart and I would make my Mondays light. Like I would only have maybe one or two classes and the rest of the day was for planning. So I didn't have to worry about making up that many classes because I had scheduled for myself. Yeah. All right, what was I going to say? And then it really started getting to me, because I am a person who really always wants to do what's right. I never want to be somebody who's done something wrong. I'm a people pleaser. And I started working with my kids, and I adored working with my kids. But then I would look at them, and I would think, oh my God, if they only knew what you were really like, they would not give you respect at all. And it was just eating me up. I couldn't feel like I was being authentic with my kids. I felt bad for the teachers that I was lying to who cared enough about me to say, gosh, I hope you feel better soon, you know. It was just, it just really started feeling bad. I felt worthless and I felt like I was letting everybody down. And that's before my husband even knew anything really was going on. And then the luck that I have, my oldest daughter is a psychologist and she specializes in substance abuse. So you know, I'm looking for that. So they sat me down one day and I thought, oh, this is nice. They all want to talk and want to sit down as a family. I consider myself to be, you know, vaguely intelligent, but I am so flip and naive about everything. It's just ridiculous. I was sitting down with them and I'm like, oh, this is so nice. And then they start in on me. We really think you have a problem, Mom. You know, and that's when she said I was high functioning. I'm like, how is that a problem? And then, you know, they didn't think I was funny. But she goes, I really think you should call Farley. Because that's where she sent most of her, a lot of military and professionals went there. She goes, I really think you need to go to Farley and do a detox. I said, are you flipping insane? I said, I can't go to a detox center. Well, go to meetings. I said, I can't go to meetings. I said, I'm going to run into somebody from school and then my career is going to be gone. And literally, y'all know how much I love teaching. That was pretty much, you know, teaching is my passion. It's my life. It's what keeps me going. So I just couldn't let that happen. So I thank them very much for caring about me, but I had it together, it was all good, you know? But that put that idea in my head about Farley, that never left, it was always in there. So life went on, you know? It got worse and worse and worse. And, am I gonna do it? I Okay. I never thought I had a problem with alcohol, really. I mean, but this was scaring me. It was really starting to scare me. But I could still stop for long periods of time. You know, not a problem. You want me to stop for 4 months? I got it. That's good. I could stop. But I heard this a while back. I just could never stay stopped. You know, I could stop. You know, when I was pregnant, I didn't drink at all, but I really wasn't having a problem then that I was aware of. I would make deals with my higher power. I would go, okay. And this was, I thought I was being so selfless. This was for my kids. It was field hockey tryouts. And I'm like, if I don't drink for the whole time of tryouts, then she's going to make the team. I mean, can you believe I did that? And I would stop for that amount of time. But for alcohol to be that important that I was using it as a bargaining chip with my higher power, is that cuckoo bird? It's crazy. But then again, I could stop. No problem. I taught in Portsmouth for a long time. I was department head of my school, my high school. We would go off on conferences. That's back when they sent teachers to really good conferences. We would go to different states. And I was with a group of people that never drank. And so I would go for, you know, a whole week without drinking, no problem. So I thought, this is not a problem. Not a problem. But then it became a problem. COVID hit. That was just the perfect storm. COVID hit. I had 3 summers of knee surgeries. Had to have a knee replacement on one knee. Recovered very quickly. But then COVID happened like right after that. And so I was home, you know, and it, you know, my husband was home every other week. So that was perfect. I'd have 1 week where I was relatively dry, easy peasy, no problem. And then the next week he was gone. So it was like, yay. And I would drink in the afternoons, take a nap and be, you know, perfect little housewife when he got home. But the longer I was home and the more I was teaching with my kids, I got used to the routine. It was easy. It wasn't scary anymore. So I used to start having a glass of wine, like right at 12 when we were through teaching. And, you know, of course, that didn't last very long. And this is what, when I went to rehab, this is the thing that was so funny. He asked everybody, have any of you had something to drink at work? And I'm like, who would do that? No. No way. Seriously. No way in the world. And I really thought that until we were talking in therapy, and I was talking about the fact that I had gotten to the point where I was having a Tervis cup with wine in it while I was teaching. And he was going, oh, so you never drank at work. I said, I just didn't think of it that way. You know, but I'm a fairly animated teacher. I always have been. And so the kids were just like, they loved it. They thought, man, she's on fire today. This is fun. So it just got to the point where, yeah. And then I ran into a friend who had the same problem I did, and her and I taught elementary school, so you know, you could be goofy and they thought it was clown day. But in high school, you know, one of the teachers, her kids called her on it in a class. And she had to admit to them, you know, that she was drinking. And I thought, oh my God, this is so terrifying. But you know, COVID had me home. The knee surgeries had me home. I would have the surgery. I would have to stay, you know, on my couch for 4 to 6 weeks. I never did that though, because I can't sit still that long. But I would be there, and the pain meds, at that point, they weren't giving you really anything for pain. It was like, take an extra strength Tylenol and call me tomorrow morning. So I would take my pain meds, and then I would just start drinking, you know, all day long. I was there by myself. It was perfect. I was talking to my sponsor the other day. I love Outlander, and I love Yellowstone, and I'd watched them before. But when I watched them again after I got sober, it's like, oh, this is a good show. You know, I didn't remember half of what had happened. So that was a time when I was kind of out of it. So the next summer, I had to have another knee replacement because we were going to do both. They wanted to do the bad one first and then do the one that wasn't as bad. And home, recuperating with that again, wonderful summer. But the knee never got better. So I ended up going to the surgeon. Surgery was done in, I think that one was in August, and I went to physical therapy, and I started going back to the surgeon in the end of October. I said, this is not feeling right. This is not getting better. And of course, they were saying, you're not doing the physical therapy like you're supposed to. I'm like, what? He goes, no, you need to try harder at physical therapy. And then, I told my family. They're all like, get off that couch. You shouldn't be sitting there. You should be out doing physical therapy. And I'm like, but my leg flipping hurts. And they're like, darn. So ended up going back to the doctor in December and just not being very nice. And they took an x-ray, and the part of the knee that they had left in had been fractured for a while. So I was basically doing physical therapy and walking around on a broken leg. So had to deal with that. And all the, you know, at school, I had to go straight to, he wanted me to stay home until the surgery the next year, and I'm like, no, I can't do that. So I worked out a deal with my principal. I would get to my MOBI unit, and I would stay put, and the kids would be walked out to me so that I could do my lessons. So went through all of that, and then this is when things, you know, really, really hit the fan. I had the surgery on June the 1st, and I had to go to VCU because my surgeon admitted that he screwed up, and he goes, this is out of my wheelhouse. So I got to go see a surgeon at MCV, who's fantastic. But that took a little bit more recovery time, and so I got back home, and I'm recovering, and then that's when the girls really got, they knew something was up. So I don't know how my youngest ever knew, but anytime I ordered a black box, you know, I'd pat myself on the back, went home, I'd rip the box off, throw it away, stick the bladder under my, you know, pillow on the couch, and I'm just sitting, everything's fine. But that little booger would walk in, out of the blue, look at me, go over behind the couch, pull the bladder out, and I'm like, what are you doing? And then she would take it over to the sink and split it.
Oh my gosh.
Just let it all run out. And I don't know how she did it, but she did that 3 or 4 times. But it got to the point, wow. It got to the point with that I just realized, I remember, and I think this was a God moment, I don't know. My higher power and I knew each other, but I had, you know, hadn't really developed a close relationship. But just something out of the blue. I remember I was sitting on a chair, and I had downed another glass of wine, and I just thought, what in the hell are you doing? Is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life? Are you going to sit around and get drunk every day? I said, you know you're already getting bored with it. You know. And for some reason, that moment, I picked up the phone and called Farley. And I said, you know, I need to come and see you guys. And they're like, okay, well, when would you like to come? And this is when I started bargaining. I said, well, we're going on vacation for 2 weeks, so I'm thinking maybe in about a week or so. So I went on vacation for a week, and they were very nice. They were like, great, great. Went on vacation, you know, didn't drink in front of the kids. That would have been murder. But my poor husband would sneak me little black boxes at night. So I had drank a little bit during that week. The night before I went to Farley, I had 2 of my little black boxes, which was nothing at that point to me. It was like, you know, just an appetizer. And we drove up there on Monday morning. I had to leave everybody at the beach, because we'd go on vacation with the same group of people for like the past 40 years. You know, just on our part of the beach, everybody came those 2 weeks. So they're like, well, where are you going? You're not going to be here next week? I'm like, you know what? The damn school system has planned a teacher workshop for us that week. And I blamed it on them. And the kids, my grandkids were like, well, no, where are you going? I said, I have to go to camp. And so went to camp, everybody bought it, you know, I got to Farley. I had never done a breathalyzer before in my life. I was embarrassed to do that, but I blew a 0. Yay me, I'm perfect. And so I didn't have to go into detox or anything, you know. And then she asked me, she goes, well, how long are you thinking of staying? I said, I don't know, a week will do it. She's like, okay, you know, I knew. So I finally got into the center where I had to, you know, sign in. And the woman was just so excited that someone was cognizant enough to sign without somebody holding their hand and holding their head up. Because she said most people didn't know that they were even signing them in. Somebody had brought them there and left them, and they had no idea they were signing themselves in. Once I got there and started doing the programs, I was not impressed. I wanted to go home. I couldn't have my cell phone for 3 or 4 days until I proved I would be a good girl. So I finally, and the guy was supposed to give it to me on the 3rd day, and my counselor didn't have to work that day. So I had to wait another flipping day to get my phone. But just didn't like it all that much. But when I went in to talk to him, and then they put, it was a great day, it was structured great. You either had to do a meeting in the morning or a meeting at night. And at that time, I told you, I'm just not that sharp. I didn't realize that it was an AA meeting. I thought they were just meetings. You know, they asked me to do a meeting one day, and I treated it just like a classroom lesson. I wrote up lesson plans. And we talked about slogans. So we talked about the AA slogans, which were good. It was good. You know, why do we say this? But be that thick-headed, but anyway, it was a good lesson. They all liked it. They got to write their own slogan. So. But my therapist, that we would start that, we would have our meetings, and then we'd have like a four-hour session with our therapist and with the other people that were in there. And they had, you know, they had us do all kinds of wonderful things. But the first week in there was really hard. They had you talk a lot so that people could get to know who you were. You got to know them. And then they did like a, I don't even know what you would call it. They were like calling out your character flaws, you know, to your face without really knowing you that well. You had to examine them. No, you had to examine them yourself. And I came up with plenty. But you had to walk into the room. He sat you facing the board. Everybody else is behind you. And he had the chart on the board. And they got to tell what they saw about you. What were your defenses? What were you using to try to cover up the fact that you drank too much? And they would throw all these words out. And then he would attach them to ways to avoid those things. And it was hard, but it was a good way to get you into looking at just the things in your life that were screwed up. When you were at Farley, you were there for steps 1, 2, and 3, and with that a little bit of 4. But it was just a great experience being there. It kind of put me on the road. What else was I going to say about that? And then I talked to my granddaughter. They would call, and she'd go, "No, no." This is like 3 or 4 weeks in. That's an awfully long camp. I said, "Well, it is. You know, we have a lot of fun things we get to do." So they were into doing, they wanted us to realize that alcoholics were not a glum lot. So we had a session every afternoon where we either played games or we played charades or we went to the horse farm and did equine therapy. Or one day we had to go out and do murals on the sidewalk with chalk. And I'm sitting here. But it served its purpose because I took pictures of all of these things. And I said, "See, no-no is riding horses." So I just didn't want anybody to know that I had done something wrong. I never want them to know. But it was a great experience. It really taught me that I did have a big problem. I didn't get to leave in a week. I ended up, and they moved you all the time. They were trying to find the right match of people for you to be with. So you'd get in there, you'd unpack, you'd get to know the people, say, "Okay, maybe I can get along with these folks," you know. And then they'd move you 2 days later. And I got moved to another room, and there was a girl in there who didn't like me because I snored. And so she wanted to get rid of me, which that was fine. But I woke up one day with sniffles, not thinking anything. She turned me in. I went over to the meeting. I was there by 7:30. She'd already turned me into the office saying, "I think my roommate has COVID." And I did. I had COVID. So I had to pack up all my stuff from my apartment, and they moved me into the big house, which is where all the detox was done. But I was put into a little green room, and I had to stay there by myself for 9 days. I could not leave for any reason whatsoever. I had to wash my clothes in there, everything. And they would bring me food from the cafeteria, but it was always what was left over. I mean, one day I got like mushy broccoli mix and a hot dog that looked like it had seen better days. And I finally called my husband. I said, "I'm going to start ordering meals." So I did my lessons. I did my lessons all morning. They zoomed me into the meeting. The therapist would come to my room every afternoon, and he would laugh because I had a whole extra bed, right? So all of my notebooks were out, all of my notes were there. He goes, "Well, I know this is a teacher's room." You know, but it was being by myself for those days and not being with the group that I just thought I hated and didn't want to be around really taught me that, boy, I really miss being around them. I missed 9 days with them. So instead of, you know, begging to go home, which I had told them I wasn't staying more than, you know, a couple weeks, I ended up asking if I could stay 2 extra weeks. So I ended up staying almost 7 or 8 weeks, which was wonderful. So I finally got put back into a new apartment, another learning experience. It was like a sorority house for 40-year-olds. I mean, they were seriously, they were all military officers, and they were just living their best lives. I mean, they were drinking every day, and it was terrible. But I was in there, and I got better. Trying to think of where I'm going with this because I was going to make a big finish. But ended up staying. Oh, I know what happened. The insurance companies decided after 3 weeks that I was fine. I was fine. I could go home. This was not a residential program. We stayed in apartments, but we went to the center for the meetings. She can do that at home. Just let her stay home and go to whatever meetings you want. They didn't understand that being immersed in that whole environment was the key. So they started, the insurance people there started messing with them and messing with them. And they finally were able to get me everything paid for except for 7 days. And mind you, I'm paying for therapy, I'm paying for food, I'm paying for an apartment. So that was still pretty expensive. And this is where I feel like another God moment came in. My mother, as I said earlier, was she drank a lot. And at that point, she was just all she did was drink all day long. There was nothing we could really do to, you know, to get her to stop. She lived far away from us. She wouldn't move closer. So she ended up dying. She ended up dying the summer before I realized I was an alcoholic. And the only reason I could stay those extra days was because of the money we got from her estate that paid for my last couple of weeks there. I thought that was pretty, you know, amazing, pretty fitting that it happened that way. And it was terrible because at the time I was taking care of her, I didn't really realize that I was an alcoholic. So I was looking at her and going, just stop drinking. Just don't buy it. And I told my husband, I felt like such an idiot, you know, when I finally realized the disease that I had, because I gave her no understanding whatsoever. If I had known about the program before she passed away, I think it really could have made a big difference. I really think so. Okay, I'm getting close to time here, aren't I? Let's see. I'm sorry, guys. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about my sponsor. I came home. I started coming to this. I actually went to St. Andrew's first. And I know it's a wonderful place, but I just really didn't get the warm fuzzies the first day I went there. I just didn't. I don't know what it was. They had couches facing every which way. You couldn't see the people. But there was someone there, Mr. Steve Rocha was in the back. And I heard him talking about, you know, Gleam, come on, you know. So I went back and I said, hi, you know, my name is Steve. I was thinking of going to Glee because it's right beside my house. He goes, you should come. He goes, it's a great group. We have just wonderful members, you know, lots of women, lots of guys. And I'm like, okay. So I walk into my first meeting, and there's like four of these. It was in a small room, but it was full, and there were men around the entire table. I stuck my head in. I said, he goes, oh, come on in. You know? So I go in, and you know, I'd rather be around men than women anyway, because you knew where you stood. So I went there, and then a couple of meetings, people did show up. There were women there. And I thought, okay, all right, we're good. So I asked him for some names of sponsors. This is another God moment. It's just crazy. He gave me three names and three phone numbers. And I wrote them down, and I got two of the phone numbers reversed. So the person that I thought I was calling was not who I was calling. So I left a message, and that person said, well, I'll get back to you, you know, around 1 or 2. And I'm like, okay, you know. But before then, somebody else called. You know me, I'm thinking, gosh, they all want me. They want me as a sponsor. And I realized that I had mixed up, and this is just crazy, I had mixed up another lady's number with Faye's number, who has been my sponsor since day one. So that's another thing that would not have happened if something hadn't had their hands in there. And this starts the period of torment in Faye's life. Because she would say, okay, we're going to read the foreword, and we're going to read, like, you know, chapter 1 and 2. And so I would come back to her, and I would have notes. I had this word means this, and this. I mean, I was like a teacher. I took it apart. I had the notes. I knew my stuff. And she's like, it's good, but, you know, how do they make you feel? And so then I would go. It took us, like, 6 months before I really, you know, caught on to it. And then, you know, since then, I feel like I've learned a great deal. I just did one of my first amends, which was to my mother. So that's done. So I'm ready to, you know, to do some more. another thing that just really caught me off guard, the weekend that I was doing my amends letter to my mother, we took a break and we went shopping and we went into Office Depot. And David's over, he goes, oh look, there's all these cheap books up here. He found one, it just kills me. It had elephants on the cover, and I love elephants. They're like my spirit animal. And it had an elephant, a big grandma elephant with a little baby elephant, and the title was, Don't Forget Grandma Eleanor. Guess what my mother's name is? Eleanor. So it was just another, you know, odd thing. But that's kind of my story. Faye has brought me through so much. I have some of the best friends I have ever had in my entire life that are women. It's just amazing. But we went to a meeting the other night, and this was the daily reflection, and it just cracks me up because this was me to a T. You can't think your way sober, because that's what I was doing. It says, to the intellectually self-sufficient man or woman, many AAs can say, yes, we were like you, far too smart for our own good. Secretly, we felt we could float above the rest of the folks on our own brain power. That was me. My intelligence and where it had gotten me, that was my whole being, you know. And it said, even the most brilliant mind is no defense against the disease of alcoholism. I have learned that very well. I can't think my way sober. I try to remember that intelligence is a God-given attribute that I may use. A joy, like having a talent for dancing or drawing or carpentry. It does not make me better than anyone else, but it is not a particularly reliable tool for recovery. For it is a power greater than myself who will restore me to sanity, not a high IQ or a college degree. And that's what I've learned out of really really trying hard and connecting with my higher power. It's still a little hard for me because, you know, when I grew up, God was like this guy up there with a thunderbolt, and, you know, you either did what was right or you did what was wrong. And if you did what was wrong, look out, because, you know, you're going to pay for it. And I've done a lot of reading lately about our images of our higher powers, and most of it is it's not our relationship, it's our parents' higher power that they were forcing us to build a relationship with. So now that I realize I can have my own higher power, and I've always had something in my head that I've always talked to since the day I can remember, so it's been there, I just didn't make the connection. But thank you very much for letting me read. I mean, to share tonight. I survived. Nobody's going to have to grab me.